Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, everybody, to the Positively Trek Book Club podcast. I'm Dan Gunther, and with me is a newcomer to this podcast. I've been a guest on hers a few times, but I'm so happy to welcome Chrissy de Klerk-Zalagi to the show. Chrissy, how's it going?
It's going very well. Thank you. I'm a little time disoriented, but I think I know where I'm at. Thank you so much for calling me for this. I have been looking forward to an opportunity to be on Positively Trek, because try to be positive about Trek, so, you know, can't go wrong.
Awesome. Well, I also know you're a huge fan of the books, and you tend to read them as soon as they come out. So I was like, who could I call? And your name floated right to the top of my list.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
So also joining us, because in this episode, we are talking about a new Star Trek novel that just came out, Star Trek, the original series, Lost to Eternity, by New York Times best-selling author and Star Trek author veteran Greg Cox. And Greg is here to talk about his book. So Greg, thank you and welcome back to Positively Trek.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me. We were discussing before we started. I think it's been my last Star Trek novel. It was 4 years ago in 2020. So it's great to be back.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm so glad you're back. It has been a while. And thankfully, those 4 years have been, you know, very uneventful and quiet.
Oh, yeah. We didn't need distraction from anything that was in the, you know, the public eye, any of that. No.
Well, I certainly remember your last novel that we talked about. We talked a little bit before we started recording, which was, of course, A Contest of Principles, which at the time we had that discussion about how timely it was, completely by coincidence, all about, you know, a contested election and all of this crazy stuff going on. And it came out in November of 2020. So, boy, I'm hoping this book isn't as prophetic as that one was.
Unintentionally prophetic, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Lost to Eternity, just to outline how we're going to have this discussion, the first little bit, we'll do spoiler-free, kind of talking generalities a little bit. But we'll definitely get into spoilers later, because there is a lot going on in this novel, and a lot that is going to be fun to talk about. But, you know, we can't really do that if we don't get into spoilers. So to start with, the origins of the novel, what was the genesis of this story? How did this story come about?
Oh, that's an easy one. I can sort of remember the moment, at least for one of the,
that's cool,
the three storylines in the book. My wife and I were, for reasons, just hanging out and listening to a lot of true crime podcasts, like Serial, back when Serial was like the world. And at some point, while we were just sitting, listening to all these true crime podcasts about mysterious cold cases and unsolved murders and mysteries and missing people, at some point it occurred to us, hey, wouldn't it be funny if someone did this about, you know, a certain marine biologist who went missing in San Francisco back in 1986. And I remember my wife in particular, oh, you got to do that. And this was back again around 2020. And I was sort of looking around for the idea for my next Trek novel. And, oh, yeah, okay. So the idea of going back to Star Trek IV, which is my second favorite Star Trek movie of all time, and doing it a true crime podcast about whatever happened to Gillian, you know, Gillian Taylor. Yeah. And everything kind of, you know, spiraled from there as I then had to figure out how to get the TOS crew into it and make it a Star Trek novel. So it wasn't just, but yeah, for those, and I'm going to be careful about spoilers because the book literally came out last week. So mm-hmm. I am not so arrogant to assume that everyone has already read it, you know, within, you know, 6 to 5 days of it coming out or so.
It's summer. People got time. It's all good.
The structure is the book is set in three different time periods, and I sort of hopscotch between them, alternating chapters. There's a story set in 2024, now, there, which involves a intrepid young true crime podcaster who decides to do her hot new podcast, Cetacean, about whatever happened to Gillian. Then we jump back and forth to the 2260s, where we're in the middle of the original 5-year mission, and we have a sort of classic TOS TV era adventure, where Kirk and company are looking for another scientist who has gone missing under mysterious circumstances, not Gillian, someone else. And then the third plot line takes place in the movie era, somewhere between the fifth and sixth movie, and heavily features Savik, who's involved in her first major diplomatic mission involving first contact with mysterious alien race. I jump back and forth between these three storylines, which, without getting too spoilery, you know, eventually turn out, it seems like they're three different stories, but it turns out they are, in fact, connected in ways that I hope will be surprising and unexpected, hopefully.
So that kind of anticipates my next question, which you kind of answered, I guess. I was wondering which came first, the idea to follow up on Gillian Taylor or the story of this Syroth slash all these other aliases he goes by, this quest for what he's after. And I'm guessing the Gillian Taylor story came first, and then the kind of how to weave that in came after.
Yeah, I started with the podcaster storyline, said 2024, but because this is, of course, a Star Trek novel, I realized that, well, it couldn't just be modern day San Francisco. So I needed to get some actual Star Trek into it, Kirk, Spock, the Enterprise, Klingons, Romulans, etc. But everything did sort of follow. Okay, in that case, I need something. And also these days, you know, I wanted it to be a big long book. Pocketbooks is kind of, sorry, gallery books these days. It's all Simon Schuster, just different imprints. Want sort of bigger, more ambitious books than, you know, back in the past. So I found that my way of doing that is to have an A plot, a B plot, and a C plot. So I have enough plot to get a nice, you know, hefty book here. So the idea, that's what the idea of, oh, instead of setting it maybe on three different planets or how about three different time periods. And then a lot of, like, the plot line you alluded to meant it followed logically, I needed a storyline that could extend over, you know, 300 years or so. And that, so the same, and that sort of followed logically from there. And like I said, once I decide I'm doing the movie era, that's when, oh, well, I should do something with Savik, because what makes a movie era storyline different from a TV era storyline? Well, one of the obvious changes is Savik. So fine. That's a Savik story is not a story you can set during the 5-year mission period. So that I was also very concerned with the fact that even though I'm jumping back and forth from storyline to story, so it's literally sort of, you know, A, B, C, A plot, B plot, C plot, A plot, B plot, C plot, etc. I was very concerned that the reader always knew what storyline they were in. And one of the tricks of that was that, okay, if you pick up one of the 23rd century chapters, and the first paragraph is, that is not logical, Savik says. Well, you instantly know if the point of view character is Sovic, you know you're in the movie era, you're not in the TOS TV era. And that was very much a thing. Again, it all sort of follows logically. I'm trying, I'm going to start a story in 2024. I need to bring in another time period. Hey, let's be crazy ambitious. Let's bring in two time periods and then find a storyline that can actually weave across from 2024 to 2292. And then from there, how do I keep the various storylines distinct so that the reader is never lost? Hopefully, the goal was that you open to chapter 12 and, you know instantly what storyline you're in.
The numbering helped. The years at the front of it helped a lot.
Yeah, I also like it. I actually, each chapter does have a timestamp on it. But just to make it even easier, I wanted to make it sort of clear.
Speaking as an historian, I really wish more authors would do that just in general.
Oh, God, yes. And also, speaking as someone who watches a lot of historical TV shows and reads historical novels, I spend too much time reading, trying to figure out, where are we? So we're in old-timey New York. Are we in the Gilded Age? Are we in the Roaring?
Yep.
God's sakes, just tell me, Brooklyn, 1925. So ditto watching historical mysteries or something on PBS. Okay, so it's London. Are we pre-war, post-war? Mm-hmm. How many, are we Downton Abbey? Are we Grantchester? I don't know. So
you start looking at hairstyles and clothes and you're like, okay, the collar's like this. All right.
I will say that my wife is much better than this time. She is much better at being able to pin the era by the clothes styles and also the car styles.
Oh, the cars.
Where is this? The 20s, the 30s, the 40s. She'll look at, 40s. Okay. Mm-hmm. The clothes, the cars, She's more visual than I am.
I love that.
So I've got to imagine it. And we kind of, like I said, we talked a little bit before we started recording. Your notes and like how you kept this all straight must be pretty substantial given how complicated the story is and where the characters are and what's going on kind of thing. What was that process like? Do you have like one of those big boards with the red strings connecting everything?
Or? Yeah, a crime board. No, it was actually all done on, there was a lot of yellow legal pads and a lot of index cards all held together by rubber bands and being shuffled a lot. And one thing that I'll admit, I did not write the book in the order in which the chapters appear.
Hmm. I see.
I could, that makes sense. You wouldn't necessarily have to do that in this case.
I did not want to lose momentum and have to mentally shift gears.
Yeah.
So I basically wrote the book chronologically. And then when I was done, I had the lovely challenge, grab the antacids, of then trying to find the way to interweave them, which, required a certain amount of nipping and tucking and changing and altering it. And it was really sort of fascinating. When I was done with that, I realized that the re-scrambled book, the remixed book, was very different from the book I had written, in that certain big reveals were landing in different places. Because I wrote it all chronologically. I suddenly realized that, we are meeting certain characters in 2022 before we meet them in 2024, whereas I had written the whole book chronologically. I'm actually gratified the book's come out, and so far it seems to be getting a fairly warm reception, that I was a little, things are landing and some of the emotional beats are hitting differently because I wrote it straight through from the beginning of the Melinda storyline. Melinda is my favorite podcaster, all the way through to the 22, not in order. And then I reshuffled all the chapters and suddenly realized that, like I said, things are landing differently, that we meet certain characters in different storylines before we meet them in the early storylines. And
yeah,
so suddenly it became sort of the reader not going, oh my God, so-and-so is that character we met earlier. It's more kind of a case of, oh my God, this guy back then was that character we meet later down the road. So the book is a different book than the book I wrote in a way after it got reshuffled.
That's interesting. You got to be cognizant of what the reader knows and when and all of that. That's really fascinating.
Yes, and that's where the fine-tuning and nipping-tucking came in, right? And indeed, the structure, the format I hit, and forgive me if this is getting too technical, for the first part of the book, I managed to maintain a pretty good ABC mm-hmm. structure. This breaks down at some point. There's a point in which I realize, I cannot go any further in this storyline without giving away spoilers for that storyline. So after a certain point, there's a point where, okay, the 2292 storyline goes away for a while because I can't go any further in this storyline without giving away spoilers for the other two plot lines. And then we get to the end, the last four or five chapters. Now that we've wrapped up the 2024 storyline, we've wrapped up the 2260 storyline, it's time to now go into the finale when plots converge, you know. And the last five chapters are all finally set at the end of the story chronologically. Mm-hmm. But yeah, these are the issues I dealt with sort of that were peculiar to this book. And they were peculiar. Yes, it's a peculiar book.
In a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things I noticed too, we talked a little bit about how you differentiate between the different time periods. I notice the tone of each period is very specific to its era. So I loved reading the 2260s one because it felt very TOS. Like Kirk is kind of just riding that edge and being the maverick and doing all the action-y stuff. And then the 2290s, Kirk and all of that is very diplomatic, very like we've got to maintain this peaceful balance between all these governments. And this is just kind of the era we're in. 2260s, it's like, yeah, we got to be careful, but those darn Klingons, we're going to end up fighting them at some point. You know, like it's just the tone mm-hmm. was struck really, really well for those.
I'm not sure if I conceived of that originally, but as I started writing the book, I leaned into that very heavily. The TOS book is me trying very much to capture not the feel of TOS, but also one of the more action-filled and, dare I almost say it, pulpier aspects of TOS. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, there are fist fights and judo throws, and there's some good Kirk foo going on, mm-hmm. and there's action and adventure. So I was sort of leaning into that, whereas indeed the movie era feels more like, say, The Undiscovered Country or something. It's all political intrigue. There's also a difference with the setting. I don't know if you noticed that the TOS storyline is very much set down on the planet. Mm-hmm. And they're running around. It's the landing party is running around having adventures, and there's action, and you know, there's gladiatorial combat in an arena. There's mm-hmm. ferocious alien beasts. I was kind of a little bit leaning into my inner Flash Gordon, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs here. My sort of original high concept for that was sort of okay. I'm going to actually lean into sort of old fashioned space opera here. And was what if the Enterprise crew, you know, circa, you know, the 5-year mission, ended up beaming down to one of these planets like Mongo from Flash Gordon, barbaric world full of warriors and beasts and running around and having sort of swashbuckling adventures. The TOS storyline is set on the planet, whereas the Sophic storyline, the movie era storyline, is almost entirely set on ships. I'm not giving you, there's three different ships, a Klingon ship, a Romulan ship, and, you know, the Enterprise. And I don't think there's no beaming down to the planet in it. And it was also sort of intentional that, yeah, when you pick up a chapter and if you don't notice the timestamp, oh yeah, you pick up the TOS chapter, Kirk is riding a weird alien beast across the desert. He's fighting giant bird monsters, etc. And, you know, McCoy's being his irascible self, damn it, Jim, you know. Whereas if you pick up the, going to the Sovic storyline, it's all shipboard. It's all scenes on the bridge and the sick bay, corridors, engineering rooms. It's all, imagine humming machinery in the background. And I'm not sure I realized that until I was writing that, oh, I'm going to really lean into, this is the what, where if you're down on the planet running around and there's vast scenery and there's castles, yes, there's a castle and, you know, wild animals and things, you're in the TOS storyline. If someone is having a tense diplomatic dinner on board a Romulan, you know, warbird, you know you're in the other storyline, even if Sovic isn't, you know. So yeah, one is ship-bound, one is planet-bound, one is more action-oriented, the other one is more sort of, like I said, almost sort of, you know, diplomatic high stakes among, you know, various different galactic powers and things, all of whom want to make first contact with the same alien race, and kind of there's a bit of rivalry going on there.
I feel like while I was reading the TOS stuff, a couple points I was like, oh, I know what set they'd use for this.
Yeah, and what music is playing in the background.
Yes.
dun, dun, dun,
It took me a minute to remember that the TOS Klingons did not necessarily look like the movie era Klingons, and they're talking about blending in with a population, and I'm going, how? Oh yeah, that's right. And I love that you made the point of the description there, because that clicked in my head and made it go, oh yes, that's right, they can blend in.
Yes, those are very much, it's weird, yeah, those are very much TOS Klingons.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think that at least I tried to portray the TOS Klingons more like TOS Klingons.
Well, that feels like probably a pretty good place to say we're going to shift gears here and talk spoilers. So this is your official spoiler alert for anybody listening. You can listen on if you haven't read the book yet, but if you do, I seriously question your life choices, because you should pick up this book. You should read it. We are going to spoil it, and it is very much worth reading. I'll give a little clue as to my final thoughts at the end of this, which is I love this book. It ticks so many boxes of things that I love about Star Trek. So go read this book, come back, listen to this, all the spoilers, because we're going to get into it here.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode of Positively Trek is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. A special thank you to our Constitution class supporters, Jim Stoffel, Joyce Mirren, and Paul D. Kinnear. To help out with the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek, where for a small monthly donation, you can get early access to ad-free episodes, shoutouts, exclusive content, associate producer credits, and more. Thank you so much for listening, and live long and prosper. So the way I have my notes laid out is kind of, I guess, the way you wrote it, because I've got each time period here. So I guess let's jump into 2024, because this was such a joy to read this part of the book with this true crime podcast. We have Melinda Silver, who I immediately put me in mind of Serial and that kind of tone of that podcast. Her podcast, Cetacean, is looking into this old, decades-old cold case of the missing cetacean biologist, Dr. Gillian Taylor, and where she disappeared to and what happened to her. I guess my question is, was she based on anyone in particular? And I know we talked a little bit about the podcast Serial and podcasts like that. Was there, besides that, like a particular podcast you had in mind?
No, not a specific individual. We were listening to a lot of those less back then. And no, just the general tone and, you know, I'm blanking on the names of other ones. But yeah, there were Serial-inspired other similar ones. Mm-hmm. And no, I wasn't trying to specifically be, and actually, I could not have actually told you the name of the person who was the I'm bad. Who is the host of Serial, and I don't remember the names of the others, but you know, we listened to a lot of them, especially after I decided I was going to write this book, and I was just kind of going for the ambience, the tone, the voice, the sort of approach they take as they go around and do this. And I, like I said, it shouldn't be good imagination because I am in fact not a 20-something podcaster, so I was having to mentally throw myself into this sort of persona. But yeah, just. This was supposed to be just sort of a character like the people who do Serial and everything. I don't know anything about the particulars of their careers or lives. I didn't do any research into them there. But I was just trying to capture the tone and the voice of the podcasts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I watched a lot of some YouTube videos on... Or sorry, I also watched a bunch of YouTube videos because I don't really know how all this stuff works. About, you know, how to do a podcast and what to do a podcast and, you know, podcasting, there's no shortage of YouTube videos about how to launch your successful podcast series. You know, you probably know more about that than me. So I was clueless. So I had to sort of like, you know, just sort of get a feel of it.
This whole 2024 thing and following up on all of the leads that are kind of left behind in the wake of what happened in Star Trek IV. I found myself really enjoying that because I'd be reading a bit and be like, "Ooh, I wonder if she'll talk to those joggers that, oh, yep, there they are. Oh, I wonder if she," and so that was a lot of fun. How many times did you sift through Star Trek IV to find all the little kind of entry points for this?
Not as many times as you might think, because honestly, I love that movie. I practically know that part.
It's imprinted on your brain like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a few times I would go back more like the spot check and, okay, there were some nuns. What did they look like again? And go back and see. And I would maybe look up the actors who played the nuns to try to get more about it. And I also dove into Vonda McIntyre's novelization.
Oh.
Way back in 1986, Vonda McIntyre wrote the novelization. And it being a novelization and Vonda being Vonda, she fleshed things out enormously. And a lot of these bit characters in the books, in the movie, who we like the joggers, Vonda had already gone and fleshed out and given names and backstories and personalities.
Oh, cool.
Honestly, I followed her lead. Strange but true, Vonda was one of my old creative writing teachers back in the day.
Oh, nice.
So I, second generation, you know, I joke I'm a second generation Trek author since among my early creative writing teachers are Vonda McIntyre and indeed Norman Spinrad, who wrote The Doomsday Machine. But for example, okay, you remember the garbage guys, the mm-hmm. guys who are out, you know, picking up garbage in the park when suddenly there's this weird UFO experience. Wind gusts up and there's this, you know, invisible ship lands mm-hmm. in the park. Vonda gives them entire names and personalities and establishes that one of them is an aspiring writer.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
You have read the book. You'll see that I picked up with that and ran with it, you know. So that was sort of fun going back. And I'm actually, you know, not legally obliged to, you know, treat the, you know, novelization as canon or whatever. But, oh, if Vonda was going to go and give these people backstories, I'm just going to follow her lead, you know.
Yeah. And
the only adjustment I had mentally was that, oh, my God, I'm looking up. I'm seeing an amazing rainbow through my window. Forgive me. I just spotted it. But is that remembering that, God help us, Star Trek IV was nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I had to do a mental adjustment as I'm writing the book constantly to remember that, wait, you know, Jillian's boss at the Citation Institute, the one she slapped, the one who, you know, was a bit of a dick to her. Oh, God, he'd be 40 years older now. Mm-hmm. He's probably not still running the Citation Institute. Oh, the little old lady whom McCoy encountered at the hospital, the one he gave the kidney peel.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are that despite the kidney peel, she ain't still with us now, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
So having to do the mental adjustment. Oh, the Alameda Naval Base was shut down a long time ago. So I had to keep making the mental adjustment myself to realize just how long ago 1986 was.
Yes.
And that, in fact, Melinda was not even born when Jillian disappeared.
Yeah.
So that was sort of a shock when that hit me writing the book that, oh God, Jillian wasn't even born when this happened, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I died a little inside when you mentioned that in the book. I'm like, yeah. Oh God.
Yeah. But that's all right.
Well, yeah, some of the responses I've been getting from social media as soon as the cover copy started popping up online was, wait a minute, what do you mean she disappeared 40? That can't be, oh God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh yes.
1986. I mean, yeah. Throw my brain back to 1986,
That's excellent. I didn't think of the Vonda McIntyre novelization. That's really cool.
Yeah, I didn't either. I love that you stuck with the existing beta canon, though. I know you don't have to, but why create more work for yourself, right?
And why reinvent the wheel? And I admit I have a sliding scale there.
Of course.
Mean, when it comes to trying to, I do check memory data to see what's been established. And there's a sliding scale here of, okay, am I going to contradict a Dayton Ward novel that came out 3 months ago? Mm-hmm. No, I'm not. That would be tacky. Am I going to throw out a perfectly good book idea because it maybe contradicts a Bantam novel that came out in 1973? I might just fudge that. But again, it actually gives you, it's not just, it gives you, besides being faithful to the previous beta canon, it actually gives me ideas. You go digging in and seeing what's been established. Well, I can use that. Oh, the Javier, the garbage man, was an aspiring author. Great, I can use that.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Melinda's partner in the podcast, Dennis. Kind of an interesting character who I felt like maybe was a bit of a statement on the dangers of believing in conspiracy theories, even though I guess he's kind of right in this one. But I feel like I know that guy, or I've met a few people like that, that you're just a little bit like, ooh, is this feeding a kind of compulsion or something? Is that kind of based on some things you see around you these days? Or
I think those of us that spend my time on the internet and the sort of, although there's a level, there's a weird sort of level there. On one hand, yes, Dennis is the archetypal guy who gets sucked into rabbit holes and is far too gullible and gets sucked into internet conspiracy theories. He's got a weakness for he's sort of addicted to them, and this is a problem. This is a character flaw. However, there's also another joke in the book, which is that he's right, and not just about the main thing. One of the gig is all his crazy conspiracy theories, like about, Mark Twain meeting time travelers back in the past.
I love that. Amelia
Earhart being abducted by aliens, or secret experiments to create genetically engineered superhumans in India. They're all right. He's actually, like I said, I'm not just bashing poor Dennis here. He's got a weakness here and is sort of a, on one level, kind of a parody of, we've all met them in real life or on the internet, the sort of, conspiracy prone person who gets sucked into, but with the inner joke that he's actually right. I mean, Melinda is always rolling her eyes. Oh God, is this one of your crazy theories? Like, Amelia Earhart being abducted by aliens again, genetically engineered augments in India.
Crazy.
So there's a certain level, and in fact he's right. We're in spoiler land, he very early on figures out, there's a UFO involved, and I think Jillian was abducted by an invisible spaceship. And Melinda, who is much more grounded and in reality, is like, oh, nonsense. She is not quick to jump on, oh yeah, a giant invisible spaceship landed in Golden Gate Park, right. Again, since we're in spoiler land, Melinda finds out that the story she's investigating, her true crime, is a whole lot weirder than she anticipated going in. And also she discovers that she's not the only person who really, really wants to know what happened in San Francisco back in 1986. Mm-hmm. There were other parties involved. Mm-hmm. Mm.
I loved how you put right on the nose with when she says that she's the Scully to his Mulder. And I just, it was like,
yes.
And that actually, that beautifully gave me a clue early on. Like, he's, some of what he's thinking is going to be correct. Now, of course, we know going into that, some of it is, but just going forward, it was like, oh yeah, I love it. I love it. Which reminds me, did you have to get permission to use Scully and Mulder, or was it just a...
No, I did not. No, because they're just you're. I think if I brought them in as characters,
oh, of course,
of
yeah.
course. But I, you know, them making pop cultural references, you know, I think is you know completely fair and game. You know,
yeah.
To establish that in 2024, people have watched The X-Files.
I suppose that's
you know,
and, not a stretch. Yes. You know, I mean,
to a very real degree, the 2024 we see in the book is the 2024 we see outside our window right now. This is not an
absolutely.
It is our regular world. You know, Biden is president, presumably. Deadpool is playing in the movie theaters now. The only difference between this 2024, it's kind of odd. I plotted this book back in 2020. Mm-hmm. This is a version of 2024 in which, well, some time travelers from the future came back and kidnapped some humpback whales back in 1986, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, but otherwise I tried to, she's, you know, I'm sure, I can't remember, there must be some other pop culture references, but yeah. So of mm-hmm. course, I mean, if you remember, actually Buffy did this. There was an episode of Buffy had a wonderful line years ago where she said, someone is questioning her, did you seriously just Scully me? And I loved so much them using Scully as a verb. And I think Scully yeah. should be a verb. And yes,
totally.
Melinda keeps scullying. You don't seriously expect me to believe that an invisible spaceship landed in Golden Gate Bridge, you know.
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They do have very much a kind of Mulder Scully dynamic. I'm not sure that was mm-hmm. deliberate, but that was just a cute line when I wrote
oh,
it.
Oh, absolutely.
Of course, you know.
I'm never sure with those kind of references of stuff that's in copyright, you know, it's people can be really picky about that. But yeah, you're just referencing. So I didn't think of it.
If I had them running into a thinly disguised Scully and Mulder, that would be something.
Yeah.
Depending on how subtle I was about it. But no, just to have them drop up. You can have, and I'm not sure I've ever done it. You can have a Star Trek character say, you know, reference Star Wars. I don't think there'll be any legal problems. I'm not sure how I fly if he certainly found out that Chekhov was a huge Star Wars fan, but you know.
Hey, the doctor's a huge Star Trek fan, so why not?
I'm so gloating. Years ago, I mentioned Lady Gaga in a Star Trek novel, and someone wrote to me saying, oh, that was a mistake, Greg. You know, she's a flash in the pan. You know, 10 years from now, no one is going to remember Lady Gaga. And well, 10, 20 years later, that was The Rings of Time, which I wrote.
Right.
I kind of like, okay, I won this argument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that then brings me to another thing. Because again, okay, I look at the historical context, right? She mentions Woodward and Bernstein. I'm trying not to let my history teacher cynicism get in here, but I'm going to ask, were you concerned that people would not understand the reference?
I did. Actually, more than that, I worried whether or not that Melinda, given that she's like 20-something, whether that was too deep reference for her. And I kind of rationalized it, and I think I addressed this somewhere when I'm talking about her backstory, mm-hmm. that maybe the app, and I don't know, I cannot speak for, I do not wish to defame the younger generation. I do not know if that's maybe not the most topical reference to make. I mean, this is a challenge of me. Hey, I'm like 65 writing a 20-something character. I have to watch that my pop culture references aren't too dated. Given that she is an investigative journalist, given that she is, that's her career, that's her calling, that's her vocation, I think maybe, I've never tested it. I don't know if the average 20-something person on the street would reference Woodward and Bernstein. I rationalized it that she has wanted to be an investigative journalist, you know, since she was young. So yeah, she would know who Woodward and Bernstein are.
Yes, yes, I love that.
But that's an issue. I do remember some years ago, I wrote another novel where, again, at this point, not to belabor the fact that I am old, I routinely am writing characters much younger than I am these days. I wrote another book once where I had a character referencing Emma Peel. Hmm. And I actually got a note from my 20-something editor saying, and again, the character was like in their 20s.
Right.
Greg, this is really the most topical. You know, I'm not sure a 20-something person is instantly going to be talking about a cult, you know, British television from the 1960s, mm-hmm. you know. So, yeah, I went and changed the reference to Moneypenny from the Daniel Craig movies. It's something I'm conscious of.
I can tell you that most of the students in that age group do not know who Woodward and Bernstein, at least the ones that I've dealt with. But the ones who do, whoa, and they're like Melinda. I can picture her, like, you know, you've got the bit about her exposing stuff in her high school, and I can see her having that, you know, reading it, I guess, on an ebook at that point at the lunch table, you know, in high school, that kind of person.
Kind of on the flip side, and I guess, like, jumping right to the very end of the novel just for a second, I love that there's a reference to New Coke, and Melinda's like, I don't know what that is. That made me laugh.
I cannot say this with 100% certainty. I like to think I am probably, this is probably the first Star Trek novel in which anyone has ever said, okay, boomer.
Yes.
Probably.
That made me laugh.
Unless somebody said it to Travis as a space boomer. Different thing, though. But I think you're probably right there.
I remember writing that and actually trying to come up with a pop cultural reference. Because remember, Jillian is from 1986.
Mm-hmm. She is.
Melinda's from 2024. I remember thinking I need to come up with a pop cultural reference that Jillian would make that would fly over the head of Melinda. I think I spent a few minutes on the internet Googling, you know, what was hot in 1986 or whatever, the 80s, before I came up with New Coke. Yes, mm-hmm. New Coke jokes are not going to fly with Melinda. Okay. But, you know, so, yeah. I actually remember the afternoon where I kind of hit that point in the dialogue and realized I didn't know New Coke. I need a pop cultural reference from the 80s that will fly over Melinda's head, and did some Googling before I came up with New Coke.
It works.
Well, last little bit for the 2024 thing, because we should probably move on to the rest of the book as well. But I did really love tying it into the eugenics stuff, especially given your history with kind of writing the definitive books in that, the Chrysalis Project and all of that, and linking our main antagonist to that. I thought that was a really cool connection there.
For some reason, I keep going back to this era. I also did Rings of Time, which was the version about Sean Christopher's Saturn mission. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why I keep going back to the 20th century, 21st century version of Trek history, if I am. So.
Nah. Well, we love it.
Good place to be, yeah.
Well, let's move on to 2268. So we've got in the TOS era, kind of early season 3, I think you kind of narrowed it down to there. We start out with the kidnapping of Dr. Hamperian. I kind of wondered, I wondered if she was in on it early on. I thought, oh, maybe this is all a ruse. She's kind of in on it with this Fortier guy. I did not expect Fortier to just kind of be a middleman that kind of got discarded. So you did get me with that one. That was
discarded's a good word.
Yeah, literally.
I have a funny story about that. Is originally Fortier. Okay, I kill him off, right? Mm-hmm. His death scene was not in the book in the my outline, but I actually spent so much. He barely was a character in my outline. He pops up in the first scene and disappears. I spent so much time kind of fleshing him out in those early chapters, I actually realized, oh, I can't just have him fade into the background. Mm-hmm. He needs some sort of closure. And then when I came time to write the gruesome gladiatorial combat, I suddenly saw an opportunity to tie up that loose end, as it were. But yeah, Fortier ended up being a bigger character than I intended. And I realized, oh, I can't just forget about him. I need to actually do something with him and dispose of him at some point. And I did. With extreme prejudice.
It was a nice little red herring because I remember reading those early that early bit going like, okay, so this is our antagonist for the interesting. Oh, I kind of like, you know, and I didn't expect that. That was very cool.
Well, like I said, he barely existed in my outline. He was just a minor, like, plot functionary, you know, spear carrier character. And then I had so much fun fleshing him out that I realized, oh, well, at this point, he's a real character. Well, oh, yeah. I will confess to you now that I have never confessed on an interview yet. I tend to sometimes mentally cast the characters of actors as I'm filming them.
Makes sense.
Fortier is played by Peter Lorre in my head.
Okay.
I can see that.
There you see, again, my cutting-edge pop cultural references.
That's all right. The first description of, I lost his name, Siroth. To go back to Watergate, first person I thought of was G. Gordon Liddy. Bald, heavy eyebrows.
You know, I didn't think of that. I went back and forth, honestly. And I'm going to show my age here again. with Sierath kind of going back and forth between him being sort of Boris Karloff or Peter Cushing.
Oh, both. Either one, yeah.
Very good, yeah.
I went back and forth. The heavy eyebrows. Hey, he's an obsessed mad scientist. I was sort of in my head visualizing Boris Karloff or Peter Cushing. I went back. There's a whole kind of Watergate vibe to a lot of the Melinda stories with meeting the kind of the deep throat type character, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There is a bit of an X-Files vibe to that whole storyline.
Your cast of characters that you're creating, I really enjoy them. And we get another one once the Enterprise gets to this planet and they have to infiltrate the society and stuff. This guy that they rescue from being pecked to death by these creatures, Jaheed. I love this guy. He's kind of a lovable rogue, I guess. And I'm just constantly amazed at how well he just rolls with what's going on. He's like, Captain, you're called. Okay, sure. I'll call you Captain. And I can only imagine that, like, at the end when he's beamed into the transporter room, he's like, all righty then, giving me a bunch of gems and cool. All right.
Yeah, he's like I said, he's a colorful character. I was sort of leaning a little bit into sort of, you know, my sort of pulp, inner pulp author with that whole storyline. So yeah, he seems like the kind of colorful character you'd see in an old, you know, Ray Harryhausen movie or adventure film or something, you know. You're sort of cunning, charming rogue character who's, you know. And you see a lot of this also with, I'm not totally going to like Flash Gordon, Princess of Mars land here. The original TOS had that whole sort of final frontier. Nowadays, there's this idea that, you know, Star Trek is fundamentally about life in a, you know, post-scarcity utopia, which, to be all honest, isn't really the show I watched back in the 1960s, you know, which is full of lovable, charming con men, Cyrano Jones, Roger Corman, older brides. So, yeah, I was sort of leaning not in, this is the sort of, you know, colorful Wild West frontier exotica of, you know, TOS, where you do have these sort of funny characters and sort of comical roguish characters like Cyrano Jones or, you know, Harry Mudd or et cetera. And Jaheed is very much cut from that cloth. Mm-hmm. You know,
he felt like, and I mean this in a good way in this case, he felt like the kind of character that would pop up in like one of the Star Trek Gold Key comics. Like,
oh yeah.
I don't know. Just very colorful, very broad. I could totally see that.
Like I said, I'm not trying to be too, you know, I don't want to overstate this. I didn't go overboard, but in doing the TS story, I was going for the more TOS is, you know, is of course, there's more to TOS than, you know, shrills and chills and action and, you know, Kirk doing flying leaps, etc. But that is also, I think sometimes you get people, occasionally I see people talk about TOS as though it was a weekly symposium on serious topics, which indeed it addressed me. But that was not all. There was also a certain colorful excitement, Wild West, you know, bar brawls, you know. And yes, so I kind of, and Gold Key comics, this is not the world's most sophisticated TOS storyline, I'll be honest here. You know, I wasn't being deliberately campy. I didn't cross over into Adam West Batman territory. But this is leaning into the fun space adventure aspect of TOS, which was very much there, you know, fighting giant lizard men, you know, on the planet. And, you know, this is Gamesters of Triskelion, not, you know, Balance of Terror or whatever. You'll notice Kirk does get to do a flying kick. Yes.
Yes.
Ensign Martha Landon does have a judo flip where she flips a Klingon. I don't know if you remember Marco Landon from The Apple.
Yeah.
She's got some cool Emma Peel moves in that episode. So, of course. So, yeah, even the fight scenes were kind of written in terms of, you know, I will admit that I have Dayton Ward's Guide to Kirk Fu sitting at my desk when I was writing the fight scenes. Because this is, you know, haymaker punches.
Rightly so.
And judo flips and Kirk's, you know, he does the thing where he rolls and knocks somebody off his feet by diving and rolling. I was very much leaning into, like I said, I wanted that storyline to feel like, you know, a really fun TOS episode. So if we're going to get into serious politics, it's kind of like the Melinda story is the X-Files. The TOS storyline is TOS in its sort of action adventure mode. Indeed, you know, the Sovik storyline is much more sort of political intrigue, the undiscovered country, etc. I love the undiscovered country too. That's my third favorite Star Trek movie. Khan, the whales, the Discovery Country. So
yeah, the old 2-4-6 combo. I appreciate that for sure.
Otherwise known as the movies Nicholas Meyer was involved with. Nicholas Meyer family.
Absolutely. So with this TOS storyline, I also wanted to comment a bit on Kirk working with the Klingons, which was kind of a fun aspect of it. So, they're typically aggressive and adversarial, like Klingons should be, and especially in this era, the kind of more underhanded, more kind of mustache twirly type Klingons.
They're less about honor and more about poisoning the rice. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. But at the same time, also very pragmatic. Like this General Yorba knows when to work with Kirk when she has to, but also takes advantage of particular situations when she sees her opportunity to get the upper hand and stuff. So what was that like, kind of delving into this era of Klingons and writing them as like, I'm thinking in particular when they're riding the horse type creatures, I guess, and the Klingons are very inexperienced at this. It was a lovely, awkward moment there.
Mm-hmm. They need to get equestrian skills into the Klingon Military Academy. Mm-hmm. one of the peculiar, going bigger, one of the challenges of this book was there's a lot of Klingons. And there's a lot of Romulans. Mm-hmm. So one of my goals early on, which I actually put a lot of thought into, was differentiating them. You can't just, with the Klingons, have your generic, you are without honor. Six different characters all talk the same way. So I went in to try to make sure that all the Klingons, and later on, and we can talk about down the road, all the Romulans had different personalities. Mm-hmm. And yes, mm-hmm. Yorba is very much the sort of sly, sneaky, somewhat duplicitous Klingon you see like in The Trouble with Tribbles or something, or evilly finessing things behind the scenes in a private little war or a land of Troyes. I will confess now, in my head, she's played by Sarah Douglas.
Hmm.
Ursa, who was the sci-fi fantasy femme fatale in Conan the Destroyer and Super 2, etc. In my head, Yorba is played by with the same sort of cool kind of snarkiness, But yeah, and they are very much, like I said, they are, again, since we're in spoiler territory, when you're dealing with Yorba, you are very much dealing with a situation of, curse your shocking but inevitable betrayal. She is not to be trusted, but having the two of them work with Kirk and his team was a lot of fun. And something that happened, some of the stuff you plan in advance and some of the stuff that happened organically was just this very snarky relationship between McCoy and Yorba, who do not like each other or are constantly making little digs at each other. That was not planned, but that just kind of evolved and I ended up having fun with that. And that's another one of these things where I kind of like, I actually have to do something with this. I didn't intend it. So there's a little bit of closure there that the two of them are constantly rubbing each other the wrong way and they have a bit of a, sparky relationship, and he ends up saving her life at one point and she does not like that at all because she does not like being in debt to him. So that was something just sort of, I'm very much a plotter, as they say, as opposed to a panzer, but that says as you write these things and you're learning the characters, Yorba and McCoy turned out to be a sort of fun double act, as it were, which was not planned but was fun. But yes, and as you mentioned, writing them as old-fashioned Klingons who don't have bumps in their forehead. So that was deliberate. And that's another way of distinguishing them when we get into the Savi plot line, which we will be. You have another bunch of Klingons, and those are more movie-era, TNG-era Klingons.
Mm-hmm.
So even then, I tried hard to make sure that there were different personalities. There's the surly Klingon. There's the boisterous, jovial Klingon. There's the, again, sort of, dignified, stern, taciturn Klingon. Mm-hmm. The goal is, because indeed, you see this, even in TOS, you have Koloth, Kor, and Kang, who are the classic TOS, all have very different personalities.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted very much to make sure that all the Klingons were, while still being Klingon, were still, and Yorba is your sneaky, duplicitous TOS Klingon.
One last little thing from this era, I guess. Anytime Spock's in command of the Enterprise and has to do some Marshall type stuff, I really enjoy that. I love that it's just the mathematics of the situation and he's calculating and how he gauges the Klingon's going to respond to things and stuff. I love Spock in command in TOS, and you wrote him beautifully there.
he's approaching it like a chess game, you know, maybe a little bit of poker, because he's learned something from Kirk over the years.
Before we step away from that era, and actually it applies to both, I know we haven't seen most of these characters on Strange New Worlds yet, but did you apply any of what we've seen or learned there as you were doing this? Of course, you said you wrote it in 2020, so there wasn't much to...
Well, I wrote the outline in 2020, and for various reasons, the vagaries of real life, a global pandemic.
Yeah, a little bit.
I didn't get around to writing the book until later, you know, things slowed, the world shut down. And it's a slow process. Just publishing is slow, can be slow and creaky, and dealing with a global pandemic when everything is shut down. So it took a while for this book to get, the outline to get approved. We go back and forth the outline and contracts, and I'm not complaining. This is...
No, that's the realities of it, yeah.
The realities of it, and you know, and it gets scheduled and slotted. So there was a bit of a gap between me writing the outline, which honestly, I remember I started writing the outline at the very beginning of the pandemic. And I can date this because I started out brainstorming it at my neighborhood Starbucks. And then there came a point at the very height, beginning of the pandemic, pre-vaccine, when the thing was just starting and we were all getting very scared, that suddenly I was no longer comfortable. And then the restaurants all got shut down. In fact, I remember the turning point. I was literally down in my neighborhood Starbucks, working on a legal pad, plotting this book when I tried to go order some, get some, you know, pumpkin bread to eat while I was writing. And they told me, sorry, sir, we can't give you, you know, plates or utensils, or we have to use, you know, plastic and paper. And that was the point where, okay, this is getting real. It had been in the, and yeah, so I remember literally the ice didn't go back to that Starbucks for a while more. So yeah, and then times passed and things happened. So I can't even remember when I literally got the go-ahead to go ahead with the book, but there was a time delay. And so certainly this is always normal. You submit, for those who don't know, Media Tie-In 101, the way it works is they don't just give you a blank check to go off and write whatever you want. You know, you submit an outline to the licensor gets back to you, they ask for changes, you go back and forth. This can be a time-consuming process. And this is not just a Star Trek thing, this is the same whether you're writing CSI or Alias or Buffy or The Librarians. You know, the whole sort of, you know, it's a very collaborative process and there are meetings and memos going back and forth. And when the entire world is shut down, it goes down even slower.
I can imagine, yeah. Absolutely.
So Strange New Worlds come into play or no, with the way some of the characters are depicted?
I can't remember literally. I'm sure it informed it a little bit, but honestly, at this point, you know, because it takes a while for books to get published, it's been a while since I actually wrote this book. There may be a throwaway reference to a Kelpian or something, but I'm just randomly mentioning planets, because now I have a whole new list of planets I can reference, you know, just casual. You don't have to say Andorian or Tellarite all the time, you know, but I can't say, like I said, you know, obviously Sovik, no. And I think the Kirk I'm writing is very much the code from TOS.
Oh, yes.
I do know I made in Contest of Principles 4 years ago, I did throw in a snide comment about a little in joke about Spock admitting once that I once experimented with a beard in my youth. Yes. It was not universally well received.
Yes, I remember reading that. Yeah.
Right, that book came out in 2020, so already I was referring to Discovery Season 2. So, yeah, a little bit of that. But yeah, I don't think that, especially in this book, as I mentioned, I was trying very hard in the TOS segments to capture the feel of TOS. And in the movie era, my inspirations were the movie era, Sovik and just kind of mystery, Search for Spock gets referenced quite a lot. Obviously the Whale movie gets referenced quite a lot. So my brain was kind of, I love the new shows and it'd be fun to bring that sort of stuff in. My brain was very much stuck in movie era or in TOS era when I was reading that. That's where my brain was when I wrote the stuff.
You have there's a line in there, Scotty says something about, I'd rather have a beer with a Gorn. And the first thing I thought of, which would, of course, probably been after you turned this in, was the end of season 2 of Strange New Worlds when he's, you know, stuck with the Gorn. Yeah. So that was what made me wonder if that was intentional or not. And
I don't think so. I suspect by the time that particular season finale aired and that particular Scotty ran into those particular Gorns, the book was probably at least in production being copy edited.
Yeah. Just gives it another nice little layer of context after the fact, which is like, oh, that's cool. Well, let's move on to 2292 then. So this is the final time period here, set between Star Trek V and Star Trek VI, kind of in that Enterprise A era. First of all, I love Savick. I love that she's a central character in this novel. Any exploration of her is always fun. And you've got her doing, like you said, diplomacy here. And we get the lovely little scene where kind of Kirk and Spock express their confidence in Savick in this mission, even though she's a little bit, maybe a little less confident in herself here, though. So I really enjoy that. I liked playing with that character in this book here.
Well, this is where I get to be all fanboy and brag about the fact that literally a week ago, last Friday, I met Robin Curtis for the first time. And I was attending the Shirley convention. I had never met her. By amazing coincidence, the very week my book was published, the one with Savick on the cover, beamed down, as it were, to a convention in my town the week. I keep joking that I like to say I arranged for Robin Curtis to land in my town the very week my Savick book opened, but it was just coincidence. But I did take the opportunity to track her down at the convention. I showed her the book. I have to say she seemed genuinely pleased to see that Savick, and in particular her Savick, was on the cover of the book. And there was a new book about Savick. She had, so what is Savick all about up to these days? I got her to sign a copy of my book, a copy for me. And I gave her a copy of the book, which she presumably took away with her. So yeah, of course I'm going to track down Savick. I'm going to track down Robin Curtis at shore leave last weekend at the Wyndham Resort Hotel and give her a copy. I had one in my bag, I confess. I had a spare in my bag just in case I ran into her that weekend. And sure enough, Friday night, I walked up and, introduced myself. So that was fun.
Well, there you go. That's the weird coincidence for the publication of this book. Yeah. And I'll take that over the, horrible election.
Exactly. You're right. I had the weird coincidence of, the disputed presidential election landing in November 20 last time. This time we will live with Savick arriving in my hometown the week my book comes out. Okay.
Yeah, that's a good
much better. I love it.
I enjoyed doing Savick. Like I said, the main reason there was, again, what makes a TOS story, a movie era story different from a TOS story? Well, Savick, for one thing, and the fact that Sulu is gone. This is a story takes place in a period where Sulu has gone off to become captain of the Excelsior, and Savick has taken his place as helmsman. So that automatically brings you into a different era, which I hope to differentiate from the TOS storyline.
Yeah, definitely.
And this is where I mentioned, by the way, oddly enough, I'm not done with this. I actually have another Savick story coming out in Star Trek Explorer magazine, issue number 12, which comes out, I believe, in a week or two here in August.
Something like that.
And so it is a story about the handoff from Sulu to Savick.
Cool. Oh, I like
that this story is landing, this month here in August is not a coincidence. In fact, the editor of the magazine came to me and said, "Hey, Greg, we see you have a big Star Trek novel coming out in July. Can we get a story that ties in, in the interest of synergy, can we get a story that ties in with your new novel?" And I thought, sure. And this is where I stress that you don't have to read the short story to understand my novel. You don't have to understand vice versa. They are directly, the plots are not the same, but let's set things in the same era.
Yeah.
Very cool.
As it happens, the story that comes out any day now, I'm sort of haunting my mailbox waiting for my subscription copy, takes place a little before the book, and it involves the transition involves Sulu giving Savick some advice going forward on how to fit in with the rest of the crew, how to deal with Captain Kirk. It's a very nice little vignette. It's not a big action story, and one of the things I found interesting, I went back to the movies again, about research, to see what sort of relationship Sulu and Savick had in the movies, and I discovered they don't have one. Literally, they Takei and Robin Curtis and Takei and Christy Alley barely share scenes together. I think they exchange like one line of dialogue. So, which is great. Unexplored territory. We've never actually seen Sulu and Savik interact together, and they have a little adventure together.
That's cool.
As he's going out the door and she's coming in, and that was a fun little, it's only 2,000 words long, but it was fun. And I wrote this story, by the way, years after writing the novel. But so even though it says, I tried to maybe do a little foreshadowing, and I like to think, at the risk of being pretentious, there are some thematic similarities between, you know, the two stories and Savik's evolution. I was able to go back and sort of retcon a little bit here and make sure that the Savik in that story is the Savik we meet in the novel, as it were.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's cool. I like mm-hmm. that. I'm looking forward to that. I'll get that in my mailbox soon too. So that's awesome.
The story is titled Housewarming.
Nice.
Good name.
Well, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but this is, I think, where it really comes into play here, which is all of the various Klingon and Romulan characters that you're obviously working hard to differentiate between. I liked all the different personalities and stuff. We get the drunkard Klingon who likes to party a little bit too hard, and the haughty, arrogant Romulan and all of this. I guess my biggest takeaway from this is I really, really, really want to see a Romulan with a monocle now. Like I would,
yes!
I want that on screen.
That stuck in my head. I loved it.
So good.
Well, again, that was 100% me just trying to make them visually different, even though it's a book, it's prose. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not all just big Vikings with, you know, space Vikings with clothes in their heads, giving them different personalities. And obviously, like I said, I'm very much in the movie era here. I was kind of thinking of Christopher Plummer in Star Trek VI, where he has an eye patch glued into his head. So I wasn't going to go there directly. But, a Romulan with a monocle just seemed to kind of, and he's, you know, fit, you know. Mm-hmm. And it helped differentiate him from the other Romulans in the storyline.
Yeah, just the image of him on the view screen talking with them, and like while he's talking, takes it out and cleans it. And I was just like, I can see this. Like, this is perfect.
I wanted them to all look different. And then I've got the other Romulan. Is she a Romulan? Yes, she is a Romulan, who's wearing cocktail party dresses.
Yes.
Because she's a diplomat. She's not a warrior. Mm-hmm. And she's. And I can tell you exactly where I got the idea for that. There's the scene in the Enterprise. The Enterprise incident, where an unnamed Romulan commander played by Joanne Linville, you know, let me slip into something more comfortable. And she gets out of her Romulan uniform and slips into this sort of cool, you know, sort of, you know, sexy, you know, cocktail dress to seduce Spock. And I'm thinking, okay, that's a different look for Romulans. And since that particular Romulan character, whose name escapes me at the moment, did I mention I wrote this book a long time ago? So she's a diplomat. She's, you know, sort of much more sort of whatever, manipulative. So, okay, she's not wearing the big heavy, she's not military. She's not shoulder pads and everything. She's wearing slinky dresses. She's the slinky Romulan. And that was inspired a little bit by Joanne Linville in Enterprise Interested, but, you know, sort of dialed up a little bit. So she's not a captain. She's, you know.
She kind of reminded me a little bit of, was it Caitlin Dar in Star Trek V, I guess?
Yeah. Where
we kind of see a non-military
Romulan. I thought of that, but maybe there was there. She was, you know, she was the sexy Romulan. Okay, yeah, I find this is the sultry Romulan, and I'm trying to make these characters all different, you know?
Yeah. This is where the story comes to a head. Basically, everything kind of comes together. This is the latest ploy by... he's known as Kesh now, Syroth, Orlando Wilder, all these other names he's gone by, trying to kidnap an Asori and analyze to see why they're for all intents and purposes, immortal. And this, you know, they're getting clues. They're kind of twigging. This seems familiar. And Savik, of course, has read all the mission reports, knows who this guy is. I really liked all the stories coming together here. I feel like early in the novel, it's kind of a little bit of a game, like, okay, these are three very distinct stories. How do they mesh together. And then by the time we get to the end, they're just so tightly interwoven with this guy. I really enjoyed kind of seeing how that came together here.
And you talk about where I got the ideas from. To a certain degree, the whole idea of immortality being a theme of the book. And in fact, that Orlando Wilde, Sirith Kesh, being obsessed with immortality was honestly dictated simply by the fact that I decided to start this plot in 2024, and I needed to have a storyline that carried through to the movie era, and then by definition, before I even invented the character, I need an immortal character. I need a long lived character. Mm-hmm. And once you have a long lived character, it then follows as I'm sitting in my Starbucks drinking chai tea and eating pumpkin bread, that, then if the character's main distinguished is an immortal or a guy who's very long lived, well, then immortality is going to be a theme of this book. And that's what I'm going to, again, just sort of follows logically the minute you decide you're starting the plot in 2024 and you're ending it in the movie era. You need at least one character who can continue throughout the plot. Although the funny thing is, we talked about me shuffling the chapters, and that's what I was kind of thinking about when it lands. We actually meet Kesh, and we actually meet Sirith long before we meet Orlando Wilder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My original sort of thought as I was writing the books in chronological order was that when we finally met Sirith and when we finally met Kesh, the reader would go, it's Orlando Wilder. Well, in fact, it ended up working backwards, that you meet Kesh, and you go, Kesh is... No, later on, when we meet Orlando Wilder, you realize, this is Kesh, this is Sirith, who we've already met in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also that weird moment when, during the TOS storyline, when Sirith is sort of like, hi, Captain Kirk, we've met before, at least from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Kirk hasn't met him yet, because, the Kirk who is running around in 1986 was, in fact, movie era Kirk.
Yeah.
Sirith meets Orlando, knows of Kirk. Although he said, we meet again, although you're much younger now than the first time we
met. Yeah.
It's like, what the hell do you mean by that? And, just a private joke, he said,
Yeah, it's kind of shades of River Song in Doctor Who, or more recently, I guess, Wesley Crusher in season two of Prodigy, where he says to Dal, right? He's like, have we met yet? No, we haven't met yet. Hi.
Yeah, exactly. There's some Spoilers. Of that going on.
Exactly. Oh, that's excellent. I love that, of course, now with the conclusion of the 2024 storyline, what happens at the end of that, we're now bringing Melinda Silver into the 23rd century.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the like quick catch up via mind meld. That was clever.
I got to admit, one of the moments, like I said, I'm not going to be too self-congratulatory here, that I really loved seeing. I loved writing, and I thought like my favorite punchline maybe in the entire book is, we are smack dab in the middle of the Sobic storyline, and we have left Melinda way behind in 2024. And then we suddenly get, Sobic meets this mysterious woman on the other side of the galaxy in 2022. Mm-hmm. And I end with the line, I still remember the sentence. I don't remember the names of the characters, but I remember the sentence.
All right.
What the hell, said Melinda Silver. the intent was that, readers' jaws would drop at that some point. And that's the moment when the 2022 storyline and the 2022 storyline just bang collide. And oh my God, they just literally, when Melinda meets Sobic and the storylines finally come together, I remember hitting that point, writing the book and going, yay. And not just because it meant, the book is almost done, I'm going to hit my deadline. But also because, I've been sort of building towards this, even when I was writing, especially when I was writing the book in chronological order, at that point, I hadn't written Linda for a month or two, because as I'm writing all this other stuff, and finally, bang, this is the payoff I set up way back at the end of the Linda chapter storyline.
Well, and I feel like my favorite laugh out loud moment reading this book was, Captain Kirk, wait. Captain Kirk was Jillian's pizza date? What the hell? That was great. Yes. I guess finally at the end of the book, we have what I've been like waiting for this whole book is seeing Jillian Taylor.
Yeah.
And then we get the added bonus of Melinda actually being there to meet Jillian Taylor mm-hmm. and see the culmination of her work here. That scene was just such a special scene. I imagine that must have been so much fun to write, those two characters coming together.
Also, honestly, it was also kind of like pressure was on. Okay, I've been building up to this moment for the entire book. This scene needs to land because, you know, Melinda's been looking for Jillian. You know, we could have subtitled this book, you know, Star Trek, The Search for Jillian. So, okay, we are finally meeting Jillian. Melinda is face to face with Jillian. I can't dash off this scene. This scene needs to. And so I remember feeling a certain pressure that I have to stick the landing here.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, I admit, after the book was announced, there was a certain trepidation. I'll admit, because, you know, you're an author, you're very insecure, we're nervous. Okay, whatever. We're arrogant and we're nervous. When the first book was first announced months ago, everyone was like, oh my God, they're bringing back Jillian. Oh, what great, so great, Jillian. I had a moment of, my heart sank a little bit. Because, okay, spoiler alerts, you don't meet Jillian until the final pages of the book. It is The Search for Jillian. It's like, you don't see Leonard Nimoy until the very end of The Search for Spock. You know?
Right.
And I started to get a little nervous. Oh my God, do I have to do something to manage expectations here? Because everyone's expecting a novel about Jillian.
I feel like I was one of those people saying that.
Am I going to get ripped to shreds because the book comes out and Jillian is only in the last three pages? You know. I took a certain amount of comfort when they finally announced the cover and Sovik was on the cover and everybody was like, oh boy, Sovik's back. Oh boy, I can't wait. And suddenly that became the story. And I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, thank God, because the Sovik is, it really is a Sovik book. Mm. If you buy this book wanting to see Jillian, well, you're going to be waiting a long time. There's lots of talk about Jillian. She is endlessly discussed. It's all about Star Trek IV. People talk about Jillian, what was her like. She goes to her friends, her coworkers, people she knew, you know. Melinda spends a lot of time trying to figure out who Jillian is, what was Jillian's deal. You know, Melinda becomes low-level obsessed. You know, you know, Dennis is not the only person who goes down rabbit holes. Melinda becomes pretty heavily obsessed with Jillian. And one of the things I do like about that ending, because we're in spoiler territory, is because it's a true crime story. Melinda starts out thinking she's probably going to find out that Jillian, you know, died horribly, murdered and is buried in a field somewhere. Or at the very best case, her best case scenario is she finds an elderly, you know, 80-year-old Jillian living somewhere in a nursing home, you know, to actually find Jillian and, oh my God, you know, it's a young, healthy, vital Catherine Hicks.
Yeah, outlived everybody.
as I make the point, since we're in spoiler territory, that true crime podcasts don't tend to have happy endings.
Yeah.
They may have closure, you may find justice, you may get answers, but you don't get a happy ending.
No.
Citation, the podcast, has a happy ending.
No.
We find Jillian and she is alive and well and thriving in the 23rd century.
It's not only murders in the starship, it's a happier ending for sure. So that's good.
I will say one thing, other thing is I do my homework. One of the other inspirations for this book was there was a graphic novel by Chris Claremont, Debt of Honor, that came out back in the 90s.
Got it on my shelf right there, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, as you recall, Jillian is in that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and reread that, which I hadn't actually in decades. And if you notice the ending of that final chapter, I am very much taking inspiration from what Chris Claremont, and I'm blanking on the artist's name, how they showed, what they showed of Glinda, what they showed of Adam Hughes, was it, maybe?
Yes, Adam Hughes.
Yeah. When we see Jillian in the 23rd century, it is, in fact, consistent with what we saw at the end of Dead or Alive. Yeah. So you'll notice, where did I get the idea for that? Again, I shamelessly, standing on the shoulders of giants, again, I reinvent the wheel. I'm going to show Jillian living her best life like we saw her in Dead of Honor, which, strangely, there hasn't been a whole lot about. I think she's made a few other cameos in the comic books. But I did some research, and yeah, Jillian was sort of unexplored territory, so.
Yeah, and one ripe for exploration, I think. You do get to kind of play with some of the lore here as well, though, too, with the kind of introduction of what's going to end up being Cetacean Ops in the future.
You asked me if I'd actually referenced the new stuff. I forgot.
Well, yeah,
Of
that's
course.
true.
Citation Ops. Of course, I reference Citation Ops, which, you know, in the book. And yes, that I did actually draw inspiration from Lower Decks. I think Citation Ops had been established earlier on TNG in passing,
yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
Lower Decks that really ran with it. So yeah, there's that there you see Lower Decks going into it, you know.
Love
and,
it.
Yeah, the Jillian is the founder of Citation Ops just makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also don't think that's a huge surprise. I saw many people in the lead up mm-hmm. to the book coming out guessing and anticipating that.
Mm-hmm.
Because
makes
it's
sense.
It's just such a logical thing to do, and yeah. You know, I'm sure 5 million fanfic authors have already done it. You know, but in this case, it's like, oh, I need to, you know, defy expectations. I need to, like, I can't do that. It's too obvious. It's like, no it's logical. I'm not mm-hmm. going to not go there just because it's perfectly logical. You know,
she was a marine biologist. She's not going to suddenly become an astrophysicist or something. That doesn't
right.
Yeah.
So yeah. What does a marine biologist do in Starfleet?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm. That's it.
And since, like I said, this is the epilogue of the book. It's not like it's the big spoiler that's going to blow the whole plot or anything. You know?
Mm-hmm.
We're an hour past that anyway. It's all good.
Well, yeah. I guess I'll just wrap up by saying, like I did before, I love this novel.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a lot of fun, and I know there's a lot you're probably not able to tell us, but what do you have coming out soon, or what are you working on that you can tell our audience, other than, of course, your short story coming up, which we're all looking forward to now?
Well, in fact, in the manner of being a writer, I have various fires in the irons. I have outlines sitting on desks. I have contracts that have not yet been signed and stuff I'm not at liberty to talk about, but oh, like I said, I have a new Sovik story coming out in issue 12 of Star Trek Explorer magazine. I believe I have another TOS story coming out in issue 14.
Ooh.
This is also a classic TOS story, which is kind of my comfort zone, TOS. And it hasn't been officially announced yet, but I was given permission recently, because I went off a convention, to mention that I recently sold a large horror novel. This is not Star Trek. I have a big horror novel that will be probably coming out in 2025, 2026. And I am chuffed about this because, believe it or not, this is actually my first original novel. It's only taken me 65 years. No, I've written many, many novels in various different franchises, mm-hmm. X-Men novels, mm-hmm. Batman novels, a good deal of Star Trek novels. But yeah, while stuck at home during the pandemic, I finally, if I'm ever going to write a novel that is not based mm-hmm. on a pre-existing IP, I should do it now. So yeah, I wrote a big 130,000 word horror novel.
Nice.
It doesn't have a pub date yet. I won't mention the publisher yet, but I was given permission the other day because honestly, I was going off to shore leave the convention and I was like, oh, please, please God, can I talk about the new book? Yeah, yes, Greg, you can sit in the bar and you can talk about the new book. You know. So I'm sure there will be more Star Trek in my future. I don't think I'm giving any way to say that I have outlines sitting on desks waiting to move forward. And in the meantime, like I said, I wrote a big horror novel. I'm waiting for my editorial notes on that. And there will be more, like I said, I'm no doubt going to be continuing to write short fiction for Star Trek Explorer magazine.
Excellent. And if people want to keep up to date with what you've got going on, where is the best place to do that online?
Honestly, I'm on Facebook a lot. I'm again old. I'm not super big into all this. I need to discover the exciting world of Instagram and TikTok. And honestly, I probably like a half a dozen different Star Trek Facebook fan groups,
mm-hmm.
you know, about Star Trek books and just general Star Trek and Star Trek the original series. So I have a presence. I spend, you know, on Facebook and chatting with people. Oh, also the Trek BBS, which has been around for.
Yeah,
classic.
There is a sub forum for Trek literature, and not surprisingly, I'm there a lot, and I'm especially there a lot when I have a brand new book that just came out a week ago. So, and you know, I don't have any conventions lined up immediately, but I'm sure there will be more conventions and book signings down the road.
Perfect. Well, thank you so very much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. And Chrissy, we should probably share with our listeners what you do, what podcasts you've got going on, and where they can find you.
That's true. All right. Well, I'm the rest of the time I'm over on the BQN. And on there you can find me on two of those podcasts. And the first of those is the Trek One, Infinite Diversity. And there Thad Haight and I discuss each new episode of Trek as it's released, usually with a guest. I'm trying to think here. We've got one more episode discussing Prodigy coming out next week. And then we're going to be on a bit of a hiatus until I guess Lower Decks is the next thing coming up.
Yeah, October 24th, I think.
That sounds, We got a few ideas, some episodes in the meantime, but in terms of our usual things that we do. And then the other one, which is not Trek related, except on occasion when I have a little bit of fun with it, is History with the Zalagis. And that's a short history podcast I do with my fellow historian husband, Jason. It's supposed to be twice weekly, but life has been life. When we get back to school in a little under a month, we're thinking, as strange as it sounds, our schedule will be better, even though we'll have more to do, and we'll be back to twice weekly. But there's a nice back catalog, and they're nice and short, 10, 20 minutes at most, for the most of them. And then I'm on the various socials as the Goddess Livia. That's THEGODDESSLIVIA. And then on Facebook as well, but I'll be honest, I have been trying to not be on social media as much. So I will chat, but you might have to wait a few days unless you directly tag me, which I probably shouldn't tell people to do. So, but when I am on those, you can see my opinions about Star Trek history and leftist politics. If that doesn't put off your listeners, which I'm pretty sure it wouldn't.
No, we've weeded out pretty much all the people who will hate that.
Good.
I hope so. Excellent. Yeah, yeah. We like everybody too much. So
yeah, you know, I mean, it's just like that whole being nice to people and not judging them. Yeah. Totally not related to anything except for the fact that it's TOS era. Okay. My co-host Thad is at STLV this weekend, and he ran into Lawrence Luckinbill, and he happened to be wearing a shirt he made. Thad was wearing a shirt that he had made up after a particular line was on Lower Decks, which was Vulcan as a, and
yes.
Lawrence Luckinbill stopped him and asked him where he got the shirt.
Brilliant.
He sent us a picture of it in a little chat group, and Luckinbill's wearing a Harris cap. And I'm like, yeah.
Oh yeah. That's awesome.
So,
so cool. Well, you can find the podcast at positivelytrek.com. Reach out to us, positivelytrek@gmail.com. And of course, in all the social medias, just search for Positively Trek. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. And you can do that in the Positively Trek discussion group on Facebook. Just agree to the rules and we'll let you right in. Thank you all for listening this week. Thank you once again to Greg Cox. We really love having you here and we can't wait till we have you back.
Well, hopefully it won't be 4 years this time.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for listening. And until next time, stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. so you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.